was real too.
Yeah, of course, I dived into the ditches. I felt all the more whizzing by and what saw them hit in the dust. I couldn't believe it. And I sort of stood there for a second, and suddenly when I dived in this ditch, and this plane went on, and I looked up, and there was one of these old Koreans again, with a hat, black coat, with his long beard, and he was facing me, and he looked up, and there was a great big grin on his face, as if to say, "You stupid bog, what are you doing?" Because I was waving to the plane. Okay, the strangest things you do, and don't believe that they could be shooting at you, their own people, you know, and shooting at refugees, because there were no real soldiers, they were all old men, old women, and young women and children. Anyway, when we got further along, and there was a sort of a gap between the hills that the road went through, and when I got up there was a lot of dead children and people. And of course, the Koreans came to me, and I could assume that what they were saying was, you know, why? What have we done? Why are the Americans, our own people, doing this? I obviously didn't have an answer, but I couldn't tell them if I did, because they wouldn't have understood the English. And it was, I mean, to see them burning these children on the side of the road, because that's what they did, built little pyres and cremated them then. Well, it tore me apart, I think. And when I eventually reached the rock lines, which was a couple of days later, so I was away about 10 days, I thought. They had an American padre then. I've told him what had happened, and you know, how upset I was, that these people should be, our own people should be shooting refugees. Their only desire was to get to safety amongst our own. Anyway, he took me to see the commander, I don't know, it was a general of some sort. And he said, well, he felt for what I told him. He said what had happened, they'd been told that they'd seen, you know, reconnaissance planes had seen Chinese soldiers changing into civilian clothes and mingling with the refugees. And that was why they were doing it. And I must admit, I wasn't very satisfied. I've never had them. Never seen that. I can understand that. To have a roadblock and pick them out, yes. I mean, if you get a roll back and see healthy young men amongst these refugees, then you know there's something wrong. They should be in either the South Korean army or they are the enemy. But to shoot refugees' mind, having again said that there were, I know for a fact from later on, that there were Chinese and Korean young women dressing in schoolgirls' clothes, you know, high school. But they were in fact communist soldiers, and they obviously were sent in disguise to, I suppose, they would report back. And when we were at, I think it was Suwon later on, that was really icy. We were guarding the railroad, and this girl came and wanted to, and she had duffs, which British Army Forces money is. And I don't know how she got these. So we then marched her into the headquarters and told them, look, we don't know who she is or anything, so we better know the intelligence to put it from there. But we believe that this happened on a number of occasions. So it was a very traumatic 10 days and I got back to the region.
What condition were you in?
Dirty and tired. But settled back in the job. Had a shower of sorts. Just got Harry Petley, my mate, to get a bucket of water and throw it over me. Washed myself down, you got another one and washed it off. So that was about it. Because we didn't get much in the way of showers or washes or anything. Like wash your hands and face was about the most you can get. So just after that, we went from there to what we called Christmas Valleys, where we spent Christmas. And there we went in to get some scouts and things off the Americans, because they had stuff and we didn't have it, Turkeys and things like that. We went with the RSN and the Sergeant Major Strong in the truck to get us these things. And there we saw these, believed to be a North Korean southern, that they were being lined up in trenches and then shot in the head and then kicked into the trenches. We actually saw it.
By whom?
The South Korean, by the police. The South Korean police. They've told them spies. So they could only assume that's what they were. The punishment was swift. Swift justice. Okay. But again, the newspapers actually took that up later on, or at the same time they took it up. And,
how many did they execute?
I don't know. But at the time we saw them, it was about 100. They were shot in the back of the head and put into the trench. I don't know if they dug the trench themselves or if they dug them or what.
Where was this Christmas Valley?
Do you know, the one thing about, we didn't know very much about where we were most of the time. Well, I suppose the officers knew, but the men didn't know. We knew when we were in Sudan. I went to Sibian Leave, which was, I didn't actually go to, but the others did. And that was the first action the regiment was involved in. And that was where the sea company got ambushed, and the carrier got mined, and Lieutenant Weaver, who was a reservist, he got taken out, but he actually came back after we'd all been captured.
So you're in this Christmas Valley at Christmas time. What happened after this?
After that, we went up to the front line, and we dug in. I will never forget this one. There I die. We dug in through, well, we dug 6 feet, and it was ice all the way. And the picks were bending, you know, the way you're digging in. And it was flying all over the place, ice in your face, in your eyes. Having done that, we then filled sandbags and first aid floors up. And we could have defended that place forever, that's what we felt. And then we understand the Auster rifles, we were in reserve position behind the Auster rifles and the Northumberland Fusiliers. And they got heavily attacked, badly mauled. And as I understand it now, that Tom Brodie, the brigadier, he didn't want to lose any more, so we were ordered out. He didn't want to lose the whole of his brigade. He lost, I think, something like 80 Auster rifles in one fell swoop, and that was big. They called it Happy Valley. That was, I think, 10th or the first or second.
Were you digging in Happy Valley?
We'd actually dug in, yes. We'd done everything good, you know. Nothing would have moved us, we felt, because unless it was a dive by a mortar, we'd be safe there. Because it was such a stronghold. All we'd done was dug trenches for them later on, I suspect. Because again, we had to move out without firing a shot. But when I didn't know until later on, that the colonel was asked to go forward to help out with the Forrester rifles in the Northumberland Fusiliers. I certainly realised what was happening, because we were on our way out and we were stopped. He stopped us, but Brody said to him, I'm sorry, I'm not going to lose all my brigade. He said, we're going to lose it to the strategic store. And so what we did, we went back and then dug it in. And about 6 miles back, I suppose, also others came through us, and as was the Northern Fusiliers, but not as bad as. Apparently, the Royal Ulster Rifles, I didn't know this until recently, the Royal Ulster Rifles had organised a retreat very well, and they would come along this, and an American plane, in all innocence, thinking to help, and drop flares, and those flares was like daylight, and there was the Royal Ulster Rifles right in the middle of this valley, and they were cut to pieces. I think they felt that we had let them down at that time. They didn't know that it wasn't up a lot, didn't they? But it would have been over then. They felt that we should help them. And I think, I know our colonel said so. As does Jennifer Hockey now, but he knows the reason why. I'm happy to say that. And there we went. Had been an army reserve, we moved back again, and then shortly after, I don't know what days or weeks, just didn't know what was happening. No, one day from another, we're either moving forward or moving back. We'd stop, dig in, and then move back, and then we then move forward. We got to this position where we were to take this hill 327, which had been the Americans been trying to take for a few days without any success, so we've been given the job. This is our real first scale battle and to capture this the hill and two ridges. And the night before we were on 50% stand to, so 50% would stand to and the other 50% would kick down, you see, for a couple of hours and then we'd change everything. And suddenly I was sitting on top of a friend, bright night, talking to another young gun called Ron Stone, talking quietly, obviously. And suddenly we heard, there was mortar, and suddenly, it didn't go off. Just plop, it wasn't plop, it was just a thump. It didn't go off. And it was within 6 feet of us. So we were very lucky. And we then, as soon as we heard the thump, we realised what it was, jumped in there. Of course, there was more mortar started coming over then. But that was the first one, and well, we were very lucky. Lucky all the way around. Then they stopped. Then it was our turn to come off today. We kept down for a while, and suddenly the mortar stopped again. So I jumped up to get in the trench. I couldn't get in, it was full. You see, the signals had come, signals from cooks and things, had come to support us, you see. And so I was lying on the side of this hill, my hands on the edge of the slip trench, and praying. Well, see, it's more to I never got a hit on anything. I'm very pleased to say. But,
why had the cooks and why had the cooks and so on come to support you?
Well, because, you know, 50% stand too. There wasn't enough of us to man these trenches and have a rest, you see. So that was their job to come home, and they were doing nothing else, as it were. So they were given the job of supporting us with us, being working with us, as indeed on other occasions happened. Because we were, as a corps of drums, we were the defence platoon for headquarters, and that was our job. Plus, during when we were going forward in action, then we were stretcher bearers. That was another job we had. Which we did the next day. We went for Hill 327, and as we went, they were going up. We were at the back, obviously, because we were stretcher bearers, behind C Company. And as they were going up, they had these identification panels on the backs. And the Centurions were lined up at the bottom of the hill. They were on jars, and they were firing just a few yards in front of our leading men. And it was brilliant. It was a treat to watch them. That was on our side, because as they kept creeping up, you see, as the chaps went up, they were creeping up. And it certainly helped, although it's still a lot of fighting went on, obviously, because they were so well dug in that you go past what you thought was an empty trench, the next thing, you could be shot in the back. And one such chap did, that was a chap named Chappy Evans, I think it was the Lance Corporal, they called. And he was up in front of us, but Corporal Thomas saw what had happened immediately, and threw a grenade into his trench with his chap one. It just popped up, shot Chappy Evans, and then popped down again. But Corporal Thomas had seen him, he was just up in front of us. And didn't actually kill him. But he blew his arms and legs off, and Colonel Carman gave instruction for him to kill him, because there's no, I mean, he wasn't going to last very long, he was obviously in agony. And that was a traumatic experience. And then this we bring it here, I remember seeing the company commander was wounded. And he said, don't bother with me, because he said, there's men up there that need more help. He said, I can get them. And in fact, somebody else came along and helped him down. But, we had porters there. So there was one wounded Chinese that was captured, but he was wounded. So the colonel said to me, take four porters on a stretcher, take him down, because we'll probably want to interrogate him. So I took him down, and then on the way down they dropped this chap. I was so angry that I laid out at him, because I don't want to kill the man, I want to interrogate him. In any case, they should have been more careful than they just be careless. But they did after that, after I laid into them. Something I normally do, but you just need to run an impulse, I think.
You mean you punch them?
Yes. Yes, I did. Yeah. Certainly didn't pick him up and put him in attention. You don't let him roll off at all. And when it's there, I mean, and reflections in hindsight, it was very difficult. I mean, it was a very steep hill. And it's very difficult. But they were more experienced at going up and down these hills than we were. I should have been able to do that quite easily. And I was more, as we were coming down, there was a newsreel team going up. One of our photographs was taken as we were coming down. That photograph is in the office, Imperial War Museum. I saw it when we were looking through a few years ago. And they took the hill within a matter of a few hours. And we came down, and things were pretty fair sailing for us. That was in February. March we went into Army Reserve. And we have a regimental day called the Back Badge Day, which commemorates the time you won a back badge, which is very unique, as you probably know. And there's also Paddy's Day on the 17th of March. So we, to commemorate it, it was our 150th anniversary of the winning of the back badge. It was 1951. We won it in 1801. And we had a supper match between us and the Ulster Rifles. That was a good day, wasn't it? And during that time, we had a reservist there, and he was awaiting court martial, and we had to look after him. I mean, he wasn't dangerous or anything like that. He was an old man by our standards. But he had refused to go up into the line. And he was a very strong Roman Catholic. And he said that he had a vision that the regiment was going to be cut off and massacred. Months later it came to him. I mean, I don't know whether there's anything to do with him, obviously, but that was what he said. And this is his excuse. And in fact, understand that he had his court martial and he got a year in prison and discharged with a big money. But he was a muscle man. Very nice.
Was he a Gloucester man?
I don't know. I don't remember him. He was a Gloucester regiment. He was a Gloucester regiment. So I can assume he was a Gloucester man. He could have been from anywhere, of course. But I have a feeling that I can see his face now. I think he had been a prisoner of war in the First War. I think this is what had done it for him. He didn't want to be a prisoner of war again, I think. And he said that he had this vision. He was talking to him with him in the evening. He wasn't tied up or anything. He was fully open arrest. Not much happened, and then I had to go down to Fushan along with a bugler from the Northumberland Fusiliers and one from the Royal Ulster Rifles to play last post and along the valley for the opening of the United Nations Cemetery. And that was a very, very emotional experience. The other two stood over one side, I stood over the other. And they played, as they played, I played the echo. That was quite emotional. I remember a huge Sikh from the Indian Ambulance Service regiment over this troop came over and said, "You made me cry." And he was tears, a big block of huge beard. experience. I know when I was late getting in. On the way down at brigade headquarters, I met an old chap who was there. Well, it wasn't old, it was the same old as me. We joined up together. He was now a captain, so I won't tell you his name. And him and a colour sergeant out of the Royal Berkshires, who knew my uncle who had been on the sons of Royal Berkshires, we had a very good chat and a good drink that night, I'm afraid, and it was the fact that I missed the plane the next morning. Anyway, they finally got me onto one of these two-seater things and put me down. And of course, we'd just come out of the line, so we were in pretty rough state, you know. So the man, American in charge of when we got to this camp, told me off a bit late, of course, and said, you know, I want to see you spick and span 8 o'clock in the morning, otherwise you'll be on a court martial. So needless to say, I was spick, they gave us new clothes, and everything was kitted out. I was spick and span at 8 o'clock the next morning, which pleased him, pleased me too. I didn't get much sleep at night. And then the ceremony was the next day. That was lovely. The thing was, everyone was pulled up. Everybody was spit and polished up to the nines. Contingents from all 22 nations, or whatever it was, at that time. And all representing. The only one who wasn't pulled up was General Ridgway, Matthew Ridgway. And he came in his combat clothes with his grenades hanging from his pockets. They used to call him Old Iron Tits. That was because of what he knew and he prided himself on everything. But he did the ceremony. It was an impressive ceremony.
So this was just before the Battle of the Yimjin, was it?
Before the Battle of the Yimjin. Because when I came back, I was away all told, I suppose. I came back to Dakota for about a week, I think. It was something like that. I had a nice time. In fact, I went out and about in Pusan and went on the launch, the harbour master's launch in Pusan. Went up the coast there. It was a beautiful day. It was a super...
Now, can you take me through the battle step by step in detail as far as you personally remember it, please?
As far as I personally, yes, I can. The first night, well, when I got back to the regiment, first of all, I was due to go on leave. But RSMO said, look, you've just had a nice week down in Pusan. It was my turn by draw to go on leave. He said, do you mind not going on leave and let Osborne, who was a sniper, who was at a rough time, he said, whilst you go away, do you let him go? I said, yeah, fine. He said, okay, well, on the 25th of April, you and I and Drummer Jones, we all go together. The talk.